This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Welcome to On Driven, Joy 94.9's multicultural program with Leo and myself, Hugh, today. The On Driven is a symbol used across Australia to represent multiculturalism, anti-racism and international understanding. At Joy 94.9, On Driven represents peace and understanding in a multicultural GLBTIQ community.
If you have any comments on the program or to ask questions, you can SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email on air at joy.org.au. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search for Orange Ribbon 949. Welcome, Hugh. We're joined in the studio today with David. Welcome, David.
Hello.
How are you going?
I'm good.
That was a very definite hello there, David.
Hello. Hello, you, Melbourne.
Yes. You have had a very interesting and busy life, which all came to alarming stop a few years ago. There's a lot to cover, David, so let's get straight into it.
Yep.
We always ask this first question first. Where were you born and describe your childhood?
Where was I born? I was born in a hospital, so it's all legitimate. But in the tiny town called Dandenong in Melbourne. In the southeastern suburbs, yes.
Why'd you say tiny?
Oh, when I was born, it was a tiny town. So,
was it?
Yeah, but they had a hospital, so I suppose it was...
Okay.
You know, now they've got a really big hospital, so that's
yes.
Good for Dandenong.
Yeah. And you grew up in Hampden Park?
I did, yes, in the southeast.
It was a big suburb, and it was like sort of country sort of...
Yeah, when I was born, it was a country town, so... But now it's part of the urban sprawl, and it's the urban sprawl's gone past that out towards Pakenham and further, even to Kooi Rup, where my niece has built her house.
Right.
Yes. But she was upset because she didn't get the first home buyer's grant for rural area. So
describe your childhood growing up. You're obviously your mother and father and your older sister.
Yeah, I grew up with three sisters, two mm-hmm. older than me, and one came along a little bit later. Both my parents were what you call factory workers back then. Dad was working for General Motors Holden in Dandenong, and Mum was a clothing machinist. So it was, what would you say, a factory family.
Mm. Hard-working.
Very hard-working family, yeah. And my childhood was terrific in Hampden Park because we'd do all those things where you could go out and get dirty and... like go yabbing in the local dam and all that sort of typical Australian stuff, which was good fun. And I had lots of friends out that way and a few close friends out that way. So,
one thing, David, you said, you know, you come from a factory background, the family worked. But one of the things you did run about the age of eight was you started ballroom dancing.
I did. Yes.
Now that's not a typical thing that let's call it working class people do.
No, it wasn't a typical thing. My older sister had an interest in ballroom dancing, and I used to go and watch as a kid from six. And I was very fascinated. I'll just move into the microphone for you, Leo. Yes, there you go.
Thank you.
Is that better?
Oh, that's lovely. So,
I used to go and watch ballroom dancing, watch my sister, and it was something I really wanted to do. And my father was heavily into the local football club, being a coach for the senior team in Hampden Park. And I don't know. I just wanted to go and dance, and I took it up, and I became a champion ballroom dancer for, you know, Australian really? Ballroom champion right. at the tender age of 13. So there was a lot of pressure on me being a ballroom dancer because it wasn't the only thing I was doing.
Was there any resistance from your dad about you taking up dancing?
Not really. My father and I, although... We had a close relationship. We didn't really have a super close relationship because he was, I don't know, he was a motor mechanic. At night time, he'd work a second job at the Hallam Hotel, which is a very sort of semi-famous hotel in Melbourne. Mm. And he'd worked, you know, I hardly ever saw him because he was always working.
Working, yeah.
And Mum used to always take me to dancing lessons, to competitions and all that sort of stuff. And it was... My life was like taken out of Strictly Ballroom. Do you know that movie? Mm,
yeah.
Okay. Well, me seeing that when I went and saw that in the theater. I was the only person that laughed at most of the jokes because I got it. Because there is nothing in that movie that was a send up. It was all for real.
Right.
Like, you know, when the mother said to Scott, you know, I've sacrificed so much for your dancing lessons. My mum used to say that to me, and I would laugh because I thought it was the funniest thing in the movie.
And did your dad ever think about trying to get you to play football or something like this?
Well, I actually wanted to play football, and I used to go down and watch. And Dad had this rule that you, at a young age, you wouldn't want to start a hobby or something like that, because when you get older, you lose interest in it. So I started football around about 11 or 12, and I was very good at it because I could run, I could leap. Because of my dancing ability.
That's right. I never thought about that.
Yeah. And but the bummer was, 2 years after I started, my vision started to go short-sighted. So I couldn't see the football anymore, so I had to give up football, and I was still doing dancing. So that probably hurt Dad a little bit. But
now, when you were younger, you also got your taste of theatre, and that was due to being in the Cub Scouts. And we actually share this passion because... when you're a scout, you can participate in a thing called Gang Show, which is like a yearly sort of theatre show that scouts put on. And you were involved with it, weren't you?
I was involved with the show for 13...
Ten to 13
years.
I did 1 year of it.
Did you? I've got to say, it was the most amazing time in my childhood. Because at school, I was sort of the outcast of school. I was picked on because of my size and my other abilities that I could do outside of school. But at school, I wasn't very good at succeeding. Like, I didn't pass school. I got up to year 11 just. And at the age of 8, I knew I wanted to become a chef. So I had all that on myself, and then theatre outside of school and all that. So after school, I'd get in the car and then drive to the city to go to rehearsals for the gang show. And this was a yearly occurrence. But I loved doing it because I had people that understood me and who I was and my flamboyance or whatever. I was a very out there sort of person.
I'm just going to go back to something you just said. You wanted to be a chef.
Yeah.
Why?
From 8.
Why?
I was a page boy at a debutante because of my ballroom dancing background. And I was in the kitchen and I saw a chef chop up a cucumber really fast. And from
then, I do that.
That's it. I just said, I want to be a chef. I want to cut a cucumber really fast. And that was a passion of mine all the way through school. So through school, and I don't advise this to anyone, I only passed the subjects I needed because I passed home economics, I passed mathematics because I thought business later on. And when I was at school, computers were coming in and I wanted to do computer studies, but because my other skills weren't so good, they wouldn't let me do computer studies. So I had to go and work in a bank later in life to discover how to use a computer.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you're a busy life. You're doing all this thing. You're dancing. You want to become a chef. But and I read also that you were in the junior fire brigade.
Yes, I was a junior fireman as well. My name's up at the wall in the Hector Park Fire Brigade as a champion junior fireman. So,
I don't know. I've never heard of this.
Where do you get the time?
Where do you get the time? What's junior fire brigade? What do they do?
Well, junior firemen, they practice how to couple hydrants and hoses and all that sort of stuff. And you learn the term female couple and male couple because the male or the female couple goes in the male couple and that's how you join them sort of thing. So it's sort of sexual at the same time. But they have competitions where they set up hoses, and when you get older you get to use water as well, and it's all done on a little concrete track.
Right.
And it's a very popular, it's a sport, and it's very popular to this day.
So you don't actually help to put out any fires?
No. Eventually you become a fireman when you're older and old enough. And
right.
then, Yeah.
Is this part of the recruitment process?
I would think so. Yeah, it's a good sport. It's a good hobby. And you know, being in a little country town, you just did everything. You had a finger in football and a finger in fire brigade and scouts and dancing and wanting to learn how to cook. So
now, in among all this, when did you discover you were gay?
Well, my philosophy is that you hear a lot of people say, you know, you've always been gay, or you haven't been gay, or it's a life choice or something like that. And I've always felt no attraction to the females. Not being rude or anything, I find girls beautiful. I can look at them and go, wow, she's amazing and all that. But sexually inside, there's nothing. I just had no thing like that. And all through my life, I was experiencing sex with a good friend, and he's now moved on and married and de facto with three children.
All through your life?
we get a bit deep here. From the age of 8.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
So you knew pretty much early on.
I did.
That's and very young.
I accepted who I was when I was 22. Because I went through going all my life thinking I'm doing the wrong thing. I shouldn't be doing this. This is wrong. What if I get caught? What, you know, what would happen? And living that life as well, in behind the scouts, dancing, football, all that. And so I was
the friend that you were having, I suppose, some sort of relationship with.
Yeah.
How old was he when he stopped?
I think around about 19, 20.
Right.
Yeah, and he chose his life, and I respect that. I was just thinking how bizarre that he's moved on to, well, not really bizarre, but in my mind at the time it was like how bizarre that, you know, I'm still sleeping with boys and he's got a de facto and having children and all that. So it was kind of hard on the old brain.
Okay, well, we have to take a break, but we'll come back to David's story very soon. This is On Driven on Joy 94.9.
Listen to us right around the nation. Joy 94.9.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
You're on Joy 94.9.
Oh.
On Driven.
Isn't that a nice song?
It's lovely. Now, David, that was, of course, from the movie Strictly Ballroom, and that was a version of Time After Time.
Yeah.
You mentioned before that you were inspired by the film, so hence why you actually chose the track.
Yeah.
Obviously means a lot to you, the movie.
I chose that track. The movie meant a lot to me because it reminded me a lot about my childhood and being a ballroom dancer and all that sort of stuff. And just that song is... Cyndi Lauper brought that out when I was dead boring dancing as well. So the timing of that was just
perfect.
It reminds me a lot about my boring dancing times and times with my parents and having my hair sprayed within an inch of its life. You know, Vaseline put on my teeth so I'd smile when I'm boring dancing. And all.
Vaseline on your teeth?
Yeah, it's an old trick. They put Vaseline on your teeth so you can smile easily because when you dance, you must keep smiling.
What does the Vaseline do?
It lubricates your teeth so you can just... open your mouth. I'm trying to show you. it's just a trick of the trade. Yeah.
Does it taste horrible?
No, not really.
Anyway.
You can't get it flavoured.
Just the thought of it. Yeah. Anyway, David, let's talk about this, I suppose, boyfriend that you had.
Playfriend.
Yeah, well, he was sort of... Well, being in a country town, I class him as my best mate, and he was my best mate for years. And we, country town, not much to do, except for, you know, football scouts and all that other stuff that I told you about before. But just we experimented a lot through our childhood growing up, and just continuously, whenever we had a time, it would happen.
But you told me something interesting, or maybe not interesting, but disturbing, maybe. It wasn't just him. You had two brothers as well.
I'm sure they're not listening, so this will be okay. He had an older brother that sort of introduced us all to that doctors and nurses sort of thing. And the brother that I was seeing for years, we just kept doing it outside of the playing in the back shed sort of thing. Mm. And at the time, I wasn't thinking I'm doing anything bad. I was none the wiser.
Yeah.
And throughout my life, and we'll talk about something that's happened in my life much, much later, I've since I go and see a clinical psychologist, and, you know, we've been talking about it, and he's put it all together, and he says it's like a form of abuse, what I went through. And I was quite upset when I was told that, because I didn't class myself as a person who'd been abused, because I always thought abuse was, you know,
something
an older man, yeah. And all that. And it just, it was like an epiphany when it came. It was like, oh, my God, yeah, it's true. And I got really angry at the fact that I'd been abused.
Because there was a younger brother as well involved.
As well, yeah. It was quite... how do I say? I could write a movie about it, because it's quite bizarre how it all happened. And I used to, like, when I came out of the closet, I used to joke about it. You know, I've been with a guy and his brother and his older, younger brother. You know, and now that I think about it,
does it make you angry that the psychologist has sort of brought this out in your brain that you were abused
at the time? Yeah, because when he did say, look, it's a form of abuse, I did go home. I broke down. I cried. I just thought, no, this can't be right. It can't be real. I don't class myself as an abused person, because when I was exploring my sexuality with my friend, I wasn't thinking I was doing the wrong thing. I was enjoying it and all that. And just eventually, you know, when I got older, everything in my life came to a halt. And
yeah.
That you'll have to stay and listen for what happened later, ladies and gentlemen.
Have you got over the anger? And
I have, and I it helps me now when I think about it. I hold no grudges against what happened, because it's something I don't want to drag up again and just bring their lives into, because they've all moved on. They're living.
Do you
their
still
lives.
See them?
No, the last time I saw them was at their mother's funeral.
Oh, right.
And that was awkward and different.
Mm.
But no, I don't see them. And I'm trying to move on with my life, because the only reason why I'm abused, or what my psychologist calls abused, is because he told me so. And up till that point, it wasn't something that I thought
you
about.
You didn't think about it?
No. So
he's brought it out on...
Yeah, and a lot of recall, he calls it, where right. he just asks the right questions and I come out with the answers going, oh, my God, you know. And things about, you know, being naked in front of people and all that, it all related back. And that's why when he put everything together, it was like, wow, I did have an issue being naked in front of other people and taking my clothes off, yet... I did go to hospital a couple of years ago, and a nurse walked in on me, and I was totally shattered because I couldn't defend myself.
So the psychologist relates that back to what he called abuse by these three brothers.
Yeah, by being naked in front of them, because I felt uncomfortable back then. And it just went, I had that oh my God moment where I went,
pfft. Yeah, this makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And
let's just move on a little bit. Let's go into something a little bit lighter, I suppose. One of the things you told us was that your mother, she taught you how to cook and sew.
Yes, she did. So both my parents taught me how to survive.
Right.
Mum taught me how to sew, how to cook, how to iron, you know, how to survive on my own, not knowing that later on in my life that I'd be single and doing all that sort of stuff. But, you know, to iron a shirt and to look after myself, it's great, because I can do it and I don't need to rely on anyone else.
Because these are the kids these days, they are not taught that, you know. No. And when you show them an iron, they're like, what does this do?
Yeah.
Or when you say, cook dinner, they're like, could go to the get some fish and chips or something. But they don't know how to do that old stuff.
Yeah, and, you know, and you can cook for yourself really easily and really, really quickly, and quite simple food, and enjoy it. Like my housemate now, she loves it because hello, Mariana, I know you're listening. Because I'm back into cooking now, because I was a chef for 14 years.
Okay.
And I gave up cooking to get an office job, which I love and I'm still doing. However, I'm back into cooking now, and I cook for her and she cooks for me and all that sort of stuff.
Okay. We'll come back to David's story very soon.
So this much to tell.
There is. There is. This is On Driven on Joy 94.9.
Your voice. Your radio station. Joy 94.9.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
You're on Joy 94.9 On Driven. If you want to get in contact with us, email on air at joy.org.au or SMS 0427 Joy 949. We're joined with our special guest, David. That was the Eurogliders.
It was the Eurogliders.
Why that track?
Because they're the best band in the world. No, Grace Knight. I was lucky enough to see the Eurogliders when I was working in the hotels when I was doing my chefing, and that band came on stage and I was like, oh my God, these guys are fantastic. They're having fun. They display everything that I like about life and being happy and joy, and that song, Can't Wait to See You, just... Mm. I get little tingles every time I hear it.
Talking of happy and joy, your theatre work obviously brings out the happiness in your life because you've done so much theatre work. And back then, you did a show called MAME, and a regular in the show was a woman from Prisoner.
Yeah, the lead role was one of the cast members of Prisoner, but no one will know her. She was the governor's secretary.
I'm sure the diehards would know that.
She was just an extra, and I recognised her from Prisoner, and I thought, oh my God, this is my first amateur theatre show outside of the gang show, and I'm now dancing with a cast member from Prisoner.
Star.
So tell me, David, do you sing?
Yes, I do. I do sing.
You've got a lot of things going on in your world, isn't it?
I know. I don't know where I used to cram it all, I swear, because I just learned so many things. I'm not a trained singer. I've learned singing through the gang show, which I was in with Shane Jacobson, who's of Kenny and Top Gear. So, and he's a good friend of mine, and he's probably one of the only people in the world that can make me laugh out loud genuinely, because he's hysterical and he's a good friend. And I should tell you, I came out to him before I came out to my family, and he was at my house. I cooked him dinner, and we were standing at the front of my house, and I said, oh, Shane, I've got something to tell you. And he goes, oh, what do you need, money or something like that? Because he was from Avondale Heights, and I thought, oh, my God, if I tell him, he's going to bash me. And I've gone, I'm gay. And he went, what? And he just walked up and he hugged me. You know, aww. And he's just the most amazing person that you'd ever
meet.
We love
Kenny, don't we?
did you tell him that he was the first person to be told?
He knows now.
No. Well, he was one of the first to tell, because he was such a close friend. And the whole thing with coming out, it's not knowing what your friends are going to do or how they're going to react or how your family's going to react. And both my parents unfortunately passed away, and as weak as it sounds, that's when I decided to come out to my family and tell my sisters.
Oh, okay. So you never came out to your parents?
No, unfortunately. Mm. And, you know, people say, do you think they know? In my heart, they know. They knew.
Of course.
Yeah. How did your family react?
Well, I've got three sisters. Two are older and one's younger. The youngest one was like, wow, oh, cool, amazing, yeah, great. The second oldest one was, yeah, okay, no problem. That's all right. We'll still accept you. Mm. And I'm like, you know, accept you as a gay. And my older sister, the next day, she called me at work and she goes, I've rung the crisis line. I said, what'd you ring the crisis line for? She goes, well, I've never been in this situation before. I don't know what to do. And I think, well, that's okay. Well, I'm still no different to the David from yesterday. All right. It's just that now you know what I do when the lights are off.
Yeah. We had a presenter here. I'm sure the listener will know who he is, Adam Stops. And I always remember him saying, you know, you've had all your life to get used to being gay. Your family need more time as well.
Exactly. Yeah, that's they a good do. Point. Yeah. And, you know, to this, they're great. At the point of coming out, I was like, they're either going to like me or they're going to disown me. Because I've heard so many stories about guys that are being disowned by their family or treated badly by their fathers and all that. To this day, my family still love me, and I'm part of their lives, and I'm part of my nephews and nieces' lives, and I'm grateful. But at the time, I was prepared to lose that. Mm. I had to psych myself to lose that, because I thought it's either going to go one way or the other.
Yeah.
And thankfully,
it's unfortunate when it goes the other way. But I think these days, though, I think most people accept.
Yeah, well, I was at the time – where coming out was just after the AIDS epidemic and all that sort of stuff. And and it was a very scary time because you saw the Grim Reaper ad on TV and, you know, it was towards the end of the 80s when the market was called Three Faces. And, and that's where I saw my first drag, which is all Candy when she used to look young. I hope she's not listening. And that sort of drag from then had inspired me to become a drag queen later on in life, which I do now.
One of your many things that you've done in your life.
Well, I went to see some drag shows and thought, oh my God, I can do better than that. I've been on stage doing songs.
So where did you do drag?
I started at the Commercial Hotel in Yarraville, just on a Saturday night.
Okay.
Then I've been lucky enough to perform with Polyfiller and their show, which they're called the Fabulous Sparklets, and I hope I'm still an honorary member of the Sparklets, because when I was sick 2 years ago, my body shut down a little bit and I couldn't walk in heels as much as I could or dance in them. So a lot of my later shows have been at I've forgotten the name, she's going to kill me, Neverwhere. Neverwhere. But that's sort of on a hiatus.
So you still do drag?
I do, if anyone wants me, call my number.
Getting back to your theatre work, David, you did a production, Me and My Girl, and that was the first time I met your love of your life so far, John.
I did, yes.
Tell us about that and John, how that came about.
I was going through a stage through theatre. It was like, you know, you'd sleep with anyone. You know, if there was someone cute, you'd make them a target.
Mm.
And John, I came into a show and filled in for a person who left the cast, and we were out to supper after rehearsal, and this might sound rude, but he heard me say, "How neat, fresh meat." And then he started playing hard to get, and then I pursued him, and it turned out from being in lust to being in love, and we were together for 10 years.
Wow.
That's nice.
Yeah, which in gay life is 70 years, they tell me. So.
And you had a commitment ceremony in your 9th year.
We did, yes.
And that sounded fantastic, like bubble machine, champagne, the VC opera, a grand piano. What was going on?
We wanted to associate our commitment to what people do when they get married. So we wanted a ring, but I wanted to have a reason why we had a ring.
Mm.
And we wanted our guests to come and have a good time at a party, because we were committing ourselves to our friend saying that we'll be together forever. He laughs. but the whole ceremony was our friends came and they waited in the foyer, and we had people serve them champagne cocktails and get them a little bit tanked. And then the doors would open, and inside from the foyer was a hall, and we had two friends from the VCA Opera sing the Lakme Duet, which is the flower drum song.
Beautiful.
And it's the British Airways song, I call it.
Yeah.
And as I was singing, our family and friends would came into the hall, and we had a circle of seats in front of John and myself. So we didn't want to walk down an aisle. We thought it was a bit dicky. Mm-hmm. So we got our friends to walk in on us, and then our families sat on the circle, my family on one side, his family on the other, and all our friends stood on the outside. And then the song finished, and we had a friend play the role of the celebrant, and she read a prayer, which was Apache Indians, and it was non-sexual, so it was neither male or female. And it was beautiful, which I sent to you, so you might want to put on your website or something that people can use. And we did that, and then we got the rings out, and the ring was to signify, because in heterosexual life it's to signify never-ending love, unity and all that sort of stuff. For us, it was to remind us that when we looked at our ring, it would remind us of the circle of friends that we had in front of us that witnessed our commitment to each other.
Wow.
So,
but after all this, David, it only lasted another year.
It did. Yeah, I don't know why. It just went bizarre. And my partner, John, came up to me and said, you know, do you want to have an open relationship? And I don't go for the whole open relationship thing. And I thought, no, you know, one man, one lover. And I just said no. And then I found out there was things happening behind my back. And I said, well, that's it. I've got to see you later. But after we kissed, we had the bubble machine go. And then this next song, which Leo's going to play.
Okay. This is On Driven on Joy 94.9. We'll come back to David's story very soon.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Kylie Minogue there with Celebration.
Imagine a bubble machine and kissing
yes,
men up the front.
And commitment ceremony. So obviously why that track, obviously for obvious reasons. She's a gay icon.
And Celebrate.
Celebration. Yeah. A celebration.
And a lot of friends said it was the best wedding they'd ever been to.
There you go. It's a big compliment.
It was, it was good. And I catered it.
Now, earlier on the show, David, we discussed how what a busy life you've led. You've done so much. And one of the things that we touched upon was drag. And your drag queen name is?
Uluru.
Fantastic. Yeah. Uluru. I love that drag
name. It's
spelled
O-O-H-L-A-R-O-O. Uluru.
And she's open for bookings.
She's very open for bookings.
So how did you come up with this name?
Well, John and myself and another friend of mine were asked to do some drag at the Cancer Relay for Life to entertain the people walking around the track.
Right.
So what better than three guys dressing up in drag? And we thought we'd give ourselves Australian names, like, because we're Aussie. So I was called Uluru because I'm a large person, like The Rock. But unlike The Rock, you're allowed to climb me.
Talking of climbing, you also play Santa Claus.
Climbing chimneys.
As well, because for the last 12 years, you've been Father Christmas to many kids, and you're the City of Melbourne Santa Claus.
I am.
Yeah. So you have the build.
That's my coming out.
You have the right build.
I do have the right build, but I do wear a fat suit. So
what an amazing thing.
Because I'm quite muscular, aren't I?
Yes.
Thank you.
So last year, you saw over 11,000 kids last year.
Yeah, in 3 weeks. Weeks.
My God. It was, what's the like being Santa Claus?
Well, it wasn't kids, because where I play Santa is at the City Square in Melbourne, and they build this little candy house, and Santa sits there for 3 hours nonstop saying, hello, how are you going, what would you like for Christmas, see you later, and they could take their own photos. So it was kids, tourists, families, celebrities, you name it, they were all there.
So what's the like being Santa Claus?
It's so much fun. It's, you know, some of the comments you hear from the kids are hilarious, and things they ask for, you've got to act like you know everything about presents and all that. And if there's any kids listening, you know, I've been specially nominated by Santa to be his representative here in Melbourne.
Right.
So,
okay. Yes. Excellent. Now, David, let's talk about something. We're going a bit sad now again. Something actually happened to you.
Yeah.
And you had a stroke.
I did have a stroke, yeah.
Just tell us exactly what happened to you.
Well, it was... I went out Friday night with a friend of mine, and we had a binge drink or a drink, a few Bacardis and Coke. And the next morning I woke up and I thought I was still drunk. And I go, I'm a bit drunk. I'm walking down the hallway funny. And this was on the Saturday, and I started to get a headache, and I just ignored it. I just thought, I'll be right. Not a problem. It'll go away. Went out that night to see a show that a friend was doing. And I was with my friend, and I said, look, I'm sorry, I'm not my normal happy self. I've just got a massive headache, and I thought it was a migraine or a middle ear infection. So the next day, Sunday, I woke up still feeling drunk, and I thought, well, this is quite bizarre. You know, I've never felt this before. Went to rehearsals for a show I was directing, Footloose the Musical, and it was our photo day for the programs, and I was talking to people, and some of the cast were saying, are you drunk? And I went, oh, no, I'm right. You know, I've had a stroke, you know. I was jokingly saying I had a stroke. And there was one girl in the cast who was a nurse, and she said to me, talk to me, do this, do that. She got me to do a few things with my hands. And she said, if you don't get in an ambulance, I'm going to wallop you one. And she sort of threatened me to get into a car, get to a hospital. Went to the hospital in Box Hill because rehearsals was just around the corner, and the nurse goes, what's wrong? And I just broke down, started crying because I've never been sick in my life. And they tested my blood pressure, and it was 280 over 160, and I should have been dead. And they took me into the hospital, into emergency. They put the ECG things on me. My sister was with me, and I said, take a photo. Look at me. I'm dying. And I was totally joking about it. And then they came up to me and said, well, Mr. Parsons, you've had a stroke. And I went, oh, yeah, okay, no worries. Just pushed it off, whatever. So stayed in hospital Sunday night. The specialist came in, got me to do a few things with my hands and whatnot, and he goes, you've had a stroke. And I went, yeah, no problem. You know, I was just brushing it off. And then the girl came in to say, we need you to write your menu for lunch tomorrow. And I went, oh, okay. So I got the little piece of paper. She gave me a pen, which I picked up in my left hand. And then I went to write, and I thought, oh, that's a bit weird. I can't, my hand's not going to the paper. And I just put the pen down just to ignore it. And then my family were there. A few minutes later, she came back. She goes, have you done your menu? I said, yeah, I'll do it now. And I could tick the boxes, but when it came to signing my name, I couldn't sign my name. And I just went, oh, my God, I can't sign my name. And my sister goes, what's wrong? I said, I can't sign my name. And I was just getting upset, and everything was just, it was all rushing. It was like, you know,
it was sinking in for
it. Yeah. And it was, I can't write my name. I can't write my name. And I threw the pen as far as I could, which is about 2 inches on the table. And I said, my hand, I can't use my hand. And, you know, previous 2 days beforehand, I was writing on a whiteboard at work because I'm a trainer and I could do all that. And then all of a sudden, I just couldn't do it. And then it hit me that I'd had a stroke. Mm. So, and it was called a Pons infarct, which is, I wasn't swearing in, which is a blockage in the stem of the brain. So it wasn't actually in the brain, the blockage. It was in the stem of my brain. And it was 7 millimeters long, and it slowly shut down the right-hand side of my body gradually. So I ignored it. Now, if you get any of those symptoms, anyone out there, go straight to a hospital and get it checked regardless. God. Because it could have been treated, but I didn't treat it and I ignored it for 2 days. And, yeah, my whole body shut down and was a life lesson.
So what was that like when that was slowly shutting down? What was going through your mind?
Well, it was just mainly my hand because I was put in a bed and I wasn't allowed to get up. So I didn't think about my legs or anything like that. And on the Wednesday, the doctors go, oh, look, you can go home now. You should be right. We organised for me to have a thing so I could get in the shower at home and all that sort of stuff. And they come to get me and say, right, it's time to get out of bed. And I said, okay. And I went to move my leg and it didn't move. So I was looking at my right leg going, come on, move, and it wouldn't move. I said, I can't move my legs. And so it was a horrible, horrible, horrible moment, and I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy because when your body shuts down, you don't have what you had a few days ago. And we all take what we do for granted because it's part of our life. But when you have a stroke and it shuts down, it's, you know, very, very scary. Not being able to get out of bed, but I could stand. I could stand, but when I was walking, my left-hand side felt normal, so I could sit with my left, but my right side was like I was winging it. So my leg would just flip across, and then I'd walk and step with my left and flip. Because I could do that, I kept on pushing myself to walk, and the nurses would say to me, we don't want you walking. I said, but I've got to walk. I have to because if I don't, I'll get worse. And they're going, we don't want you to walk. You're a large person. If you fall over, we can't pick you up. And so I'd use the rails. And every time someone visited me, I would walk them out to make sure that I'd push myself. It was easy for me because of my ballroom dancing. I could sense that half my body wasn't working properly. So when I had to relearn how to walk, I was saying, I'm not walking properly. And they go, how do you know? And I said, I can sense it. I can feel that my leg's not going right. And so just kept pushing myself and pushing myself.
At this point, what did the doctors tell you? You know, when were you planning to get back to normal?
Well, that was the thing. One of the questions they said to me, what do you want to get out of this stroke? And I said, I want to be normal again. You know, I want to be able to do what I'm doing. I want to go back to rehearsals for Footloose. I want to go back to directing the show and do all that sort of stuff. And they laughed at me. They said, ha, ha, that's not going to happen. You're going to be incarcerated or out of action for at least a year. And I was so determined to prove them wrong. I'd force myself to go to physio and do all the tests and, you know, I'd have from going from no doctor or GP, I had a doctor, a GP, a dietitian, a physiotherapist and all that sort of thing. So I had all these specialists looking after me because it was such a rare stroke as well. And I was just determined and I said, look, I'm feeling quite fine because as slow as my body shut down, it slowly came back again.
Right.
So I could start to move my hand, my fingers, but I had to do all these exercises where I trained my fingers.
Was all of this linked to the psychologist as well, or was that different?
Well, when I got home and I started to be at home by myself again, when things were, you know, I had to go and live with my sister for a while, I got back to work in 10 weeks.
Wow.
So it was...
That's quick.
Yeah, and where the doctor said I should have, you know, had a year off from work.
Yeah.
Work were amazing. They just helped me get back to it. I went home and, you know, I had to fend for myself. I had to start cooking for myself and all that. Mm. And when I went to bed, I go to sleep and then I just wake up wide awake. And my doctor said, I need sleeping tablets or something because I can't sleep. And he goes, no, what your body's doing is because it's had such a shock, when you lay down and rest, your body goes, what the hell's going on? And it wakes you up. And he says, you've got other issues as well. You know, you need to go and talk to someone. And instead of prescribing sleeping tablets, he prescribed me a psychologist. And that has helped because I now sleep. And
all the other demons came out as well.
Yeah, because we wanted to know why a person who could cook, a chef, look after themselves, know all about nutrition, know all about, you know, all that sort of stuff, why would I leave myself to have a stroke? And the psychologist has just been helping me find out why, and all the stuff that happened in my past with the brothers and my, you know, commitment to theatre and all that sort of stuff. He said whenever I did theatre and all that, that was fluff to get my mind off or put my brain into a space where I'm not in that abuse stage.
Mm.
Which
do you think you just took on too much? Too many things at the one time?
Yeah. Well, after John left, I didn't look after myself. I just, I thought, you know, I'm a fully qualified chef. I can cook whatever I want, but it was easier for me to get a pizza or get KFC or junk food. And I'd go to work and I'd have a cup of tea in the morning and then I'd train for 8 hours and not eat anything and just totally not look after myself. So
I guess at this point we should definitely show some support for the National Stroke Foundation, which you are a stroke ambassador for.
Stroke
as well.
Safe, yeah. I'm a Stroke Safe ambassador. So if there's anyone out there who wants me to come along and talk to their community groups about avoid having a stroke or, you know, looking after yourself, that's what the Stroke Safe ambassadors do. So we go out there and talk to community groups and show you how to prevent. We have a video and I do a presentation. Stroke affects over 60,000 people in Australia a year, which is more than breast cancer.
Jeez.
Yeah.
So. You don't think about it, do you? You don't think about stroke.
I mean, because we're all youngish and that's old people's disease.
yes, we are all young.
You know, and people think that it only helps old people, but it doesn't, does it? So strokefoundation.com.au, their phone number 1-800-787-653.
Yeah, and I bought you in a present, guys. This is a little business card.
Oh,
it's got the FAST symbol on it. So FAST is a national stroke thing. It's you check the face of the person who's having the stroke to see if it drops. You see if they can lift their arms. Check their speech. If they're slurring, they're not necessarily drunk.
Oh, wow.
And time is of the utmost importance. And there's a fridge magnet as well.
Oh, so thank you.
David,
we're getting presents today.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Orange Ribbon. It's been a really interesting hour. Mm. You've done so much in your life. Mm. And we'd like to thank you for sharing your life story with us.
Somebody wants to know my drag name before we go.
Yes.
Somebody's written
Brian, thank you for emailing in. His drag name is Uluru.
Uluru, yeah. You can look it up on YouTube. I do something stupid on there.
Well, the music's playing.
There is.
Thank you, David.
Went so quick.
But it is the end of the show. That is on Driven for another week. Our special thanks to David for sharing his story with us. Thanks for joining us on Orange Ribbon today. We'll be back again at the same time, 4 o'clock next Saturday, with more insights into our GLBTIQ multicultural community here in Australia and, of course, around the world. From Leo and myself, Hugh, have a great week.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.